This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hi, folks. I'm Bob Main, and the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 109 of the Handgun World Show. This is a practical show. I've got some new listeners out there, and I just want to say you've tuned into a show that's not real technical. I'm not a gunsmith, ex-law enforcement, ex-military, or even a firearms trainer. I am just a regular guy. I'm a salesman. I'm a Yankee with a gun, born in New York City, raised in Wisconsin, home of the Super Bowl champion Green Bay Packers. Now I live in the great gun-friendly state of Texas. Been here quite a few years, actually. And I'm just going to give you an everyday guy's point of view. I'm going to talk about competition shooting today. Those of you that have been listening to me long enough, you know that I like to talk about USPSA competition, IDPA competition. You know, it's fun. It builds good camaraderie. It gives you good gun handling skills. It's not the end-all be-all to your self-defense training. I strongly recommend that you take some good self-defense combat training courses with a handgun if you're going to be serious about defending yourself. But that's pretty much going to be the thrust of this show. And about once a month, I like to get Steve Zofi, who is a USPSA Masterclass shooter, on this show and interview. Well, I did just that. So that's what this subject matter is. We're going to talk about Chapter 5 of Brian Enos' book, Practical Shooting Beyond Fundamentals. We kind of put our own flavor on it and kind of give it our own take and then let you be the judge. I hope you're reading that book. It's well worth it, folks. You know, even if you're not into competition shooting, you'll just probably pick up some good marksmanship ideas on that book or in that book. So it's a complex read, and Steve and I get on this show, and we try to break it down and kind of explain to you what we think that Brian is trying to say on that. Before I get into that, I want to make a couple of announcements real quick, and I'm going to answer some listener feedback. A lot of you have been sending me some very good emails. Thank you. Keep them coming. You know, I'm an open-minded guy, folks. I believe your mind is like a parachute. It works best when it's open. And if you want to be the best shooter you can be, the best self-defense shooter that you can be, you know, folks, we don't want to have to use these guns that we carry. And, you know, I'm very serious when I say the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. I know that cops can't protect me 24/7. And we don't want to have to use them. If you're the kind of person that goes around looking for an excuse to use your gun, wrong. Don't be that kind of person. But when that day comes, if it comes, and I certainly hope it doesn't, I hope that you are ready. So the first announcement that I want to talk about is the website, handgunworld.com. And join me on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum. If you're listening to this show and you are not on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum, there are a lot of good people on there that know a lot. I mean, there's a lot of people on there that know a whole lot more about this subject than I do. There are a lot of firearms trainers on that forum. There are a lot of experts who have been doing this a very, very long time. Check it out. There'll be a link in the show notes for the Gun Rights Radio Network forum. Support Mark Vanderberg, too. He does a lot to put this together and bring all the podcasters together. Also, don't forget, you can follow me on Facebook. If you search Handgun World Show on Facebook, you'll find me on Shooters Legion, which is a good networking site. You can search Handgun World Show on there as well. And my Twitter account is Handgun World, and then I've got a YouTube account. Just search Handgun World Show on all these, and you'll find me. Last but not least, I got to say, you are a generous bunch of folks, because the sales of my Shooters Club CD digital download are going great. From now through March 15th, I am supporting the Second Amendment Foundation once again. I really believe they are a tremendous organization. They are behind a lot of lawsuits that helping us preserve our Second Amendment rights. Basically, here's what I like about their philosophy. They just seem to find cases where the state or the federal government is just flat out wrong on the gun issue. And they go after them. And they need to stay well-funded. So half of the money that I earn from the sales of my Shooters Club CD and digital download from now through March 15th is being donated to the Second Amendment Foundation. So you can do two things with your $15 investment. Only 15 bucks, folks. Where do you waste $15? Think about it. We all waste $15 somewhere. Why not help out a couple of good causes like my show and the Second Amendment Foundation? Plus, not only that, you'll get a great benefit because you'll get some information that I've never covered on this show before. Just go to handgunworld.com, click the Shooters Club CD link, and you'll see exactly how to make that investment. All right, that's it. I don't like for this show to be too commercial. So let's dive right into the listener feedback. So here comes a quick little musical break, and then I'll be on with the listener and listener feedback and emails. Here you go. Okay, time for some listener feedback and some emails here. I got a little bit of a backlog going here, so let me knock these out and kind of give you my thoughts on some of this. A guy named Brad sent me an email, and Brad said that he has a problem that's a nice problem to have. He says, I need to figure out what gun to buy with my tax refund. My budget is about $700 or less. I'm strongly considering buying a Glock 26 or 27 as a backup for my G23. I'm happy to say I'm a huge Glock fan, and I'd find it hard to go outside of the Glock family, but that being said, I'm also considering picking up a shotgun or a rifle instead of another handgun. He wanted to know what I thought about it. Basically, here's my response to Brad. Look, if you got a tax refund coming and you got $700 or slightly less, I would suggest that you buy the gun that you are least likely going to be able to afford in the future. What I mean is buy the best gun that you can get. I don't know if I would get a shotgun. I don't know if I would even get a low-cost rifle. You know, you can always get shotguns. Shotguns are cheap, folks. A good shotgun, if you shop around, you can get a good one for less than $200. So, Brad, take the money, get the best handgun. You know, a backup is probably a good thing to have. Maybe even look into a nice little five-shot revolver. Maybe a Ruger LCR or Smith & Wesson 6.42. Or a Car PM9 or something like that. You can find Car PM9s all day long, less than $700. I'd say get the good backup handgun first. And the reason being is because later on, it might be more difficult to buy a more expensive gun. Buy it now while you can, while you have the money. That's my two cents. Okay, next, Miladin sent me an email. Remember Miladin? Miladin was the guy from Serbia from episode 107 that I interviewed at the shooting range. He finally got his wife out to the range, and he said that he got her to shoot his G19, he got her to shoot his Dan Wesson CBOB 45 ACP, and his Ruger LCP. I'm not going to read the whole email. By the way, I'll put a link to his YouTube video of this. He said she didn't like the Ruger LCP, loved the Glock 19, but shot the best with the Dan Wesson 1911. That pretty much figures. You know, people typically like shooting Glock 19s. People are typically pretty good shooters with 1911s. You know, again, folks, I've said many times, nothing wrong with a 1911 if you're going to train with it. For someone who's a new shooter, I don't typically recommend 1911s because there's just a lot to learn to shoot them well. Again, remember, I said new shooter. That doesn't necessarily apply if you're an experienced shooter and you've trained and trained and trained. So, Miladin, thanks for sending me that. I'm glad, finally, you got your wife out to the range. That's cool. See, she came to watch the real-world gun match that Miladin and Josh and I shot together a few weeks back and did the podcast, and now he's getting her out to shoot. This is why I say, treat it as a family sport and get people out to the range. Okay, next up on the emails, this one comes from Woody, and he basically wanted to write to me and let me know that he's considering getting his first gun. He says he likes my podcast. You know, he kind of likes the fact that I don't do a whole lot of preaching, and I appreciate that. Thanks for that compliment, Woody. He said that he has been looking at the XDMs, and he's leaning towards either an XDM 40 caliber or an XDM 9mm. Something about the XDM guns that he really likes. He just seems to be drawn to them. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. I think that's cool, Woody. Let me just suggest this, if you don't mind. I would highly recommend that you get the 9mm. I'm not going to get into the Glock versus XD argument. All right? I know better, folks. I'm not going to touch that argument. They're both good guns. I like to carry Glocks, but don't let me influence you. I would say get the 9mm, however. I do want to try to influence you on that, Woody. Simply because if you're a new shooter, first of all, the ammo is cheaper. 9mm will do its job. If you do your part, that gun will do its part. Some of the loadings in 9mm right now, some of the cartridges and the ammo that's out there, it's fine stuff. I love Corban DPX. I also like Winchester Ranger SXTs. I like Speer Gold Dot 124 grains. Those are great rounds, folks. And, you know, stick with the 9mm. It's proven. You know, he didn't mention 45 in here, so I figure if 45 is not a consideration of his, I'll go ahead and recommend the 9mm. That's my 2 cents, and thanks for sending that in, Woody. I appreciate it. Okay, this next one comes from Monty. Now, this is an interesting one. Monty forwarded me an article, and let's see. This article is regarding a wonderful mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg. Let me summarize this for you. Michael Bloomberg, he supposedly has this crusade against illegal drugs, right? I'll put a copy of this article. It's from the New York Daily News. I'll put a copy of this article in the show notes so you can link right to it and check it out for yourself. But basically what Bloomberg did is he hired a bunch of undercover detectives to go to a gun show in Arizona recently, the Crossroads of the West gun show in Phoenix, and buy guns without background checks. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to demonstrate how easy it is to get one of these evil semi-automatics with high-capacity magazines. Oh my God, we sure wouldn't want anybody to get a semi-automatic handgun with high-capacity magazines, would we? Now, that would be awful. And, of course, this is all in the wake of the Tucson shooting, right? So he hires these undercover detectives to go there and buy guns at the gun show without a background check. Well, last time I checked, at least here in the state of Texas, I know, it is perfectly legal to go to a gun show, buy a gun from another individual. Texas still allows private sales. I believe that Arizona does too. So there's nothing illegal going on here, all right? If you buy a gun from a dealer, then you're going to have to pass a background check. You're going to have to fill out the federal 4473 form, and you're going to have to pass that background check. In the state of Texas, if you have a concealed carry license, you've passed plenty of background checks. So Texas waives the background check at the time of purchase if you have a CHL license. Here in Texas, we call it CHL, concealed handgun license. Now, somebody correct me if I'm wrong here. If Arizona does not allow private sales, please chime in, send a comment on the forum, put a comment on the page at handgunworld.com or something. But there's nothing illegal going on there. Now, what they're going to have to do is change the law. If Bloomberg really is on this big-time crusade, which I think is a bunch of garbage, I think Bloomberg's an idiot, but that's just my personal opinion, okay? Sometimes my opinion comes out on this. Then what he needs to do is try to get the laws changed in the states where private sales are allowed. There's nothing illegal about me selling my Glock with a 17-round magazine to a private person. I can do a cash sale, one person to another person. Now, I have done that, by the way. Now, one thing that I do is I get a copy of the person's concealed handgun license, and I make sure that it is indeed valid. And I do jot down their name, and I jot down their CHL number, so that I have a record of who I sold that gun to. And, of course, I've recorded the serial number of my gun. So if it ever comes back on me, if somebody ever questions me, if the guy uses that gun in a crime, then I can show the police, hey, look, okay, here's who I sold the gun to. Here's his CHL. It was valid at the time that I sold him the gun. Here's the number. Okay? I do that just to protect myself. But there's nothing illegal about me selling it to somebody without me doing a background check on him. So, you know, this devious plan here by Bloomberg, this monkeying around that Bloomberg is doing here, hiring people to go buy guns and then saying that it's, you know, illegal and so forth and they shouldn't be doing that. This is bunk. This is crap. You know, Bloomberg says, oh my God, this is, you know, if we stop this kind of stuff, this is going to, you know, prevent these mass killings. Baloney. Come on, Bloomberg, get over it. You know what? You're wrong, and you're wrong on this issue. And I thought the really interesting thing here in this article, there's a paragraph in here where it says, let's see, that Bloomberg is trying to pressure Congress to crack down on untraceable gun sales, such as those at gun shows, to reduce the supply of illegal guns on New York streets. Well, hey, Mr. Bloomberg, I have news for you. It's not an illegal gun if it's purchased legally in accordance with state law at a gun show. Then it's not an illegal gun, okay? Now, probably in the state of New York, that's not allowed. I know, because New York is a very gun-unfriendly state. But, you know, this gun show out in Arizona, unless somebody proves me wrong, I think it was a legal gun sale. Bloomberg, if you don't like it, try to get the laws changed. If you can't get the laws changed, too bad. That's just the way it is in the United States of America. That's the way our system works. So that's my two cents on that. Monty, thanks for sending in that email. I very much appreciate that. And thanks for pointing out that article. Once again, a link will be in the show notes so you can read that for yourself. Okay, that'll do it for now. That's the listener feedback and so forth. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up right now and get on to the next segment.
It was one of the worst mass murders committed by a single person. It happened down south. A lunatic killed 27 people, including his own mother, in a single pass. The killer used a six-shot revolver and a knife. Mass murderers find whatever tools they need, and those tools don't need to be sporting rifles or high-capacity clips. A slow, reloading revolver is all this fellow needed. Banning clips will not prevent a madman's massacre. But that doesn't matter to the gun control industry, who thinks inanimate objects are evil, but ignore the deranged people who misuse them. Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Okay, well, for the main topic of the show, guess who's back? The once a month discussion with Steve Zofia. How you doing, Steve?
Very good, Bob. How are you doing?
Good. Let me just remind everybody, Steve is a USPSA Masterclass shooter. That's United States Practical Shooting Association. And Steve, I haven't asked you this before. Explain to folks who might not know, what is a masterclass shooter?
Well, okay, so USPSA is broken down, and there's these things called classifications, and a classification really is the ranking of a shooter on the national level. So the different classifications are U, which is simply just unclassed, which means you haven't shot enough of the classifiers to get yourself classified yet. Mm-hmm. And then there's D class, C class, B class, A class, master class, and then grandmaster. I don't recall the percentage point breakdowns of all the different classifications at this point anymore. When I was A class, I could remember that better. But at any rate, a master class shooter is defined as somebody whose national ranking is between 85% and 95%. And presently, right now, I'm somewhere right around 93%. And then after that is Grandmaster, which is at 95 and then up to 100%. So that's what Masterclass is. Now, it's interesting that back in the day, there was the highest level you could be was Masterclass. And then when they started having so many Masters, that's when they then decided to create the Grandmaster classification to, you know, create basically just another level above the Masters where people could then expand into.
Cool. Thanks for that explanation.
Sure.
I never really knew all that stuff.
You and I have talked about this, and to me, it really doesn't mean a whole lot. I mean, it's just a it's a name or whatever to describe somebody, but I don't dwell on it too much, to be honest.
Well, that's okay. No, thanks for that explanation. So here's a question that I've got for you. From the day you started competition shooting to the day you achieved Masterclass level, mm-hmm. about how long did that take you?
Okay, so I've been a master now for, I guess, about 5 years, which, just to make things even or easy math or whatever, let's just call it roughly 2005. I started competition shooting in 93. So, okay. What, 12 years to make it to from basically D class to master class. Now, when you and I talked about this before, I don't recall exactly how long I was in D class, probably not too long. And then you get to C class, which is where a majority of the shooters in USPSA are typically C or B classed. I don't know exactly know what the breakdown is, but that's where the bread and the butter of USPSA shooters typically are. So made it to C class, probably spent, you know, a fair amount of time there. And then B class is where I seemingly peaked. And I just seemingly could not get out of B class. I stayed there for many, many years. I wasn't going up. I wasn't going down. I was just kind of like comfortably hanging right there at B class. And then when I started basically, you know, pushing, I shouldn't say pushing, but just kind of exploring my shooting technique and trying to look for new ways of doing things, that's when I basically accelerated from B to A within just a matter of months, and then from A to master in probably about another 9 months after that. So from the point that I went B to the point that I went master was roughly about 14, 15 months, give or take.
Okay, good. Well, thanks for that timeline. Obviously, it's taken a lot of hard work and practice, and, you know, that's cool. You know, there's some new listeners tuning into this show, and I just want to let them know that Steve and I like to try to get together and do this once a month. And I also want to tell everybody that Steve has his own video podcast with Rick Brenneman, who's recently been on this show talking about collectible firearms. So, Steve, plug your show here for about a minute.
Yeah, it's Power Factor Show. It's part of the Gun Rights Radio Network. We're on the forum there, so you can check us out there, or powerfactorshow.com. The intent is basically to focus toward IDPA and USPSA shooting, and we're kind of taking it from the very beginning and going forward. And what I mean by that is somewhat catering to either people who are just getting into the sport or people who are thinking about getting into it. And based on the feedback that we've received so far, it looks like we've really hit a home run in our target audience, because we're getting a lot of people who said that this is really something that they've been craving for or looking for, and the information that we're providing is really helping them out. So I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, I'm glad to hear it too. Give out the website real quick.
It's powerfactorshow.com, www.powerfactorshow.com.
Cool. I enjoy them too. Thanks a lot. Well, since you just talked about new shooters, I want to ask you to answer a listener's question. I got an email that I want to talk to you about, and answer his question and throw some of your own feedback. I'd like to get your take on this, because I'm going to email him back and I'm going to say that, you know, you answered his question because you're a USPSA guy. So I'm just going to ask him to wait until this show posts. Okay.
Okay. Sounds good.
This email comes from a listener named Billy, and he's right here in the Dallas area. He says he's a relatively new shooter, and a couple of months ago, he said he was trying to kill some time after work, so he stopped by Elm Fork Shooting Park, which, for those of you who are not from this area, Elm Fork's a pretty big shooting range that hosts a lot of USPSA. And Dallas Action Pistol Shooters is the club. Here's his question. He says, Bob, I listen to you say all the time that you have to practice, and USPSA is a great way to do that. He said, when I went to the match, I was a bit taken back by all of the gear that the shooters had. He said there was what looked like a special Velcro belt, action holsters, and lots of mag carry devices. And his question is, do you really need all this gear? Do you need all this, or can you just use your normal belt and your normal holster and pack your pockets with magazines?
My God, that's a great question, because that's exactly how I started out. When I started out in 93, I think I told you this briefly before, but in 93, I started out with a Colt Combat Commander with an inside-the-waistband holster, a really cheap piece of crap, basically. I mean, it's, you know, about a, probably like a six, I'm not kidding, probably like a $6 Bianchi, you know, inside-the-waistband with a metal clip on it holster, and I shoved all my magazines in my back pocket. I don't even think I had a really good gun belt, to be honest. At that time, but I was out there really to just improve my shooting technique, and I wasn't out there to win anything. So by all means, in the IPSC 101 classes that Rick and I and a friend of ours who actually is a Grandmaster shooter teach, we run into that a lot, where people are just in this big hurry to go out and gear themselves up for competition shooting, thinking they need to go out and get all these pouches and all these racy holsters and the other thing. In reality, that is the least of their concerns at that point. There is so much to be gained in proper technique, proper shooting fundamentals and things like that, that of having, you know, a faster holster or having faster mag pouches versus your back pocket is not going to be where they're going to pick up time. They're going to pick up time through learning to shoot and going through learning proper fundamentals and techniques and stuff like that. So what I tell a lot of new shooters is basically what you have right now probably is all you're going to need, and maybe all you're going to need for at least a year before you really get your feet wet and get out there and just get yourself exposed to it and experience it. And then after a while, you know, you can probably start exploring the idea of maybe, you know, buying a competitive holster or mag pouches or stuff like that. And another good opportunity there is to actually see what people are using so that you don't go out and buy the wrong thing. Definitely. I mean, there's no reason, you know, that's another thing I hear from people is, well, I don't have all the gear to go out and shoot it, or I don't have enough mag pouches or whatever. And they come up with a lot of excuses of why they can't go do it. There is nothing holding you back and stopping you from doing this, either in IDP or USPSA. You do have the right equipment right now, and just get out there and shoot.
You know, that's a great answer, Steve. Thanks for, because that's what I was going to say to Billy. You know, just get out there and shoot. Just go do it and worry about the gear later. Although, you know what, I'm going to empathize with Billy a little bit here, because I remember the first time I went to a USPSA match, and there were tons of gearheads there.
Oh, yeah.
And I was intimidated. I mean, I was intimidated by all these fancy race holsters and these guns and the open guns and all that. And, you know, and I thought to myself, oh, my God, how am I ever going to be able to do this?
Well, you know what, one thing there that's really important also to mention, and a lot of people, since they don't understand how USPSA is scored, is that they think that if they come out there with a production gun or a 1911 or whatever, that they're going to be competing against these guys who are using the open guns and all the racy equipment. They're not. You're shooting own separate division. You're not shooting against those guys. So don't even, you know, that's another thing we always hear is I have to have all this expensive equipment to play against these guys who are using the dot scopes and stuff like that. You're not shooting against those guys, so you don't really need to worry about it.
Great point. So, Billy, there's your answer. I knew that Steve would give a good answer. And so, Billy in Dallas, thanks a lot for sending that to me. And matter of fact, Billy, if you're listening to this, I'm sure you are, shoot me an email. Let me know the next time you're going to go over there to Elm Fork, because I haven't shot USPSA in a while, and I'll go shoot with you.
And you need to, that's another thing, Bob, is you need to look about getting your USPSA membership up to speed, because we definitely are coming down for the Double Tap Championship there in Wichita. Rick, myself, possibly two other guys from up here are coming down. So it would be a great opportunity for all of us to shoot together.
Good reminder. I need to, okay, so the last time I classified USPSA, or whatever, whenever do they classify or just run your scores?
All you need to do is this is a level 2 match. I don't mean to bore all your listeners in this, but in USPSA you can shoot. Well, okay, so let's just go over that real quick. For USPSA, you can shoot as many USPSA matches as you want without being a member of USPSA. This is true for club matches, but when you want to start playing in a little bit bigger level for what's called a level two or level three, and level two are typically like your state or, section championships. Level three is like area championships or nationals. You have to be a USPSA member. But that's
so
the only
thing to do.
You just had to be a member. You just got to resubmit your membership if you're not already.
Oh, I don't have
a member
to classify?
No. No, you can shoot unclassified.
Oh, I thought it was like IDPA that I had to classify.
No, no, you don't. You can shoot unclassified. However, it would probably be in your best interest to get classified, because if you are classified, then they will hand out plaques or trophies or something like that. And they typically, you know, somebody who's high unclassified will get a high unclassified plaque. But they'll probably be like one of those. But if you're like, you know, D class or C class or whatever, they'll have like first, second, third, B or D class and first, second, third, C class and so on and so forth. So
okay.
It would definitely be in your best. And all you got to do is shoot, I think, what, four classifiers or something, and you'll be classified.
Yeah, I think the last time I got classified was several years ago, and I think I was a C class. I'm not sure.
Oh, really?
About
excellent.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was a C class. You know, and I got away from USPSA because when I moved here to Dallas, most of the clubs around here are IDPA.
And that's the problem that a lot of people face, is that just, you know, depending on where they are, some of the clubs have a certain flavor that they like to shoot, and some of them like to shoot IDPA, and some of them like to shoot USPSA, and unfortunately, we're lucky in the area that we're in here that we have a really good mix of both, but sometimes in certain areas it's just one or the other.
Yeah. Well, thanks for reminding me. I'll get my class or my membership beefed up and have that all ready by the time you come down here.
And it could be that the USPSA actually may reinstate your classification from before. I don't remember exactly how that's done.
Ooh, that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
I'll shoot them an email and I'll ask them.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thanks for the reminder. All right, so we're talking about Brian Enos's book, which is called Practical Shooting Beyond Fundamentals. And I just want to remind everybody, because this has kind of been an issue that's been bouncing around lately, Steve and I read this book, and then we basically get on this podcast and we talk about it. So we do put our own flavor to it. We're not plagiarizing any info from Brian. It's a fantastic book. I want to urge everybody to get it. If you haven't gotten it, get it. Read it. Even if you don't like competition shooting, there's stuff in here that'll just absolutely make you better with a gun. I'm convinced of that.
That's definitely true. You know, I wish, you know, I've said I've read this book five times, and I think it could be that early on in my shooting experience, I didn't have the understanding to really realize what was going on or understand what he was saying in this book. And it wasn't until later, after shooting for quite a few years and experiencing different things, that the light bulb sort of starts going on and you really do start understanding what's going on here. But yeah, even like you're saying, is that even if you're not interested in competition, the stuff that he's talking about here applies to just shooting in general, of technique and awareness and whatnot. So yeah, I definitely would recommend this book. It's not, like we said, it's not an easy read, and there's a lot of pretty, you know, mentally heavy duty stuff in here that is kind of difficult to get your head wrapped around. But once you do understand it, it really is kind of an eye opening experience.
And it's for that reason that I took you up on your idea to do this several months ago, because you know, you and I can kind of put this into a more of a layman's language for those people who are not serious competitors.
That's very true. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking about Section 5. We just happen to be talking about competition, and some of this is repetitive to other parts of the book that we talked about. But I got some leading questions for you, and I think this will not be quite so repetitive once we get into it, okay?
Good, yeah. I think that's one of the kind of the issues with this chapter or the book, is that I think a lot of people get the book and they go, oh, there's a section on competition. Well, that's what I'm interested in, so I'm going to go straight to that and skip over the first part. And he kind of mentions here in the beginning of this chapter that a lot of you may have just ended up here or started here, and he recommends that you go back and reread the other things that he's talked about. But there is a bit of a reiteration of things that he's talked about before, particularly things about awareness and concentration.
I have to admit, I'm one of those people that quickly jumped to the competition chapter, and I started reading it, and then I stopped myself and said, no, you know, Steve and I are going to go through this together.
Yeah, you really need to. I would recommend any of the listeners who are thinking about doing this to really resist the urge of jumping straight to the competition chapter and start from the beginning, because if you start from the beginning, you'll really have a better understanding of what is going on by the time you get to the competition part.
Yeah, good point. All right, so early in the chapter, I have something underlined here in my book that I want to get your take on. Brian says that he doesn't make any distinction between match shooting and shooting. In other words, he says he doesn't use a different attitude at a match than he does in practice.
Right.
Now, I found that interesting, and the reason I want to make that the first point is because, see, I'm guilty of that. I sometimes try to change my attitude and my demeanor when I actually get into that match than I do when I'm practicing. Is that what he's talking about here?
That's exactly what he's talking about. What it really comes down to is shooting, and it doesn't matter whether you're shooting in practice or whether you're shooting in a match. I mean, it's just shooting is what it is. And the problem is that a lot of people are, I mean, when they go to the range and practice, they're relaxed because what they're really doing, there's no, you know, measurable, so to speak, outcome from what they're doing. I mean, they may be, you know, they may time some of their drills and stuff like that, but generally speaking, they're just out there experiencing the shooting part of it. Then they go to a match and all of a sudden there's kind of like a tangible outcome from what they're going to do. So immediately they have that pressure in their head that is kind of like, okay, now it's for real. You know, now All the practice we've been doing, now it's for real. And I need to, you know, this is going to be measured, so to speak. It's like, you know, it's like when you go take a test or whatever at school, you know, you can do solve all the problems all day long in the book. And you may be acing that, but all of a sudden, it's like when it's a test, it's like, oh my God, it's, you know, this big discipline counts. And the problem is that if your mind is under stress, to a certain degree, it will lock up. I mean, you just will not perform as well as what you do when your mind is relaxed. And I think that's what he's getting at here, is that people will go into a match and they'll kind of like change their mental state, thinking, okay, well, now I need to push, or now I need to drive harder. Or now I need to prove something, or I want to win the stage, or whatever it is. And when you do that, all of a sudden you're not shooting. You're not thinking about shooting. You've got something else going through your mind, you know, rattling away there, and that's what your mind starts now trying to process rather than just dealing with the shooting. So yeah, when you go to a match, when you shoot a match or stages or whatever, just try to keep the same calm, you know, relaxed state of mind that you are when you're out practicing. Don't even think about the fact that it's a stage or anything like that, and just shoot. Now, to be honest, that can be very difficult because I've shot numerous club matches and I've shot quite a few different area championships. And when we went to the Nationals for the first time, it wasn't 2010, but 2009, I got to tell you that when I hit that very first stage, it's like, I mean, I just literally got extremely nervous. It's like, oh my God, it's the Nationals. And I mean, you literally just start shaking and you get over it. But I mean, it's just that sort of, you know, it's a whole new level experiencing that you're all of a sudden thrown into, and you really need to kind of like tame the rattling of your mind and the pressure that's happening there and just try to relax and just shoot.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, that happened to me last summer when I shot the Texas State IDPA match. You know, it was really the first major sanctioned match that I had ever participated in. And I got to say, I was all practiced up and I thought to myself, okay, I'm just going to be cool, calm, and collected about this whole thing. No way.
Yeah, first stage, that goes out the window.
Oh, and you know what happened to me? I don't think I've told this before on this podcast. The very first stage, I get put on the same squad with Gordon Carroll. Gordon Carroll is probably the best IDPA shooter in this part of the country. He's the general manager of CompTac, and he's a sponsored shooter by Smith & Wesson for IDPA. Mm-hmm. He does all kinds of class. He's phenomenal. He won the whole thing, by the way. He shot SSP, by the way, with his M&P Pro 9mm. So, you know, here's basically the area's absolute best IDPA shooter, and I get put on the same squad with him.
Right, right. And now
I was just like blown away, and I was nervous, and I'm like, man, you know, it's intimidating.
Right. And the other problem with that is that when you're put into a situation like that, you feel like you need to prove yourself, or at least make it look like you belong or something like that with this, you know, level of shooters. And I know exactly what you're talking about. And
But I don't want this to scare anybody away, because I want people to understand, you're not, you know, the first several times you go, I would not suggest going to a sanctioned match to be your first, you know, 10 matches. I would suggest you just go to your local club, and the people are very helpful and they're very nice to you.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, go out there and get your feet wet at the local level. But I got to tell you that the grandmasters or whatever, they put their pants on one leg at a time like all the rest of us do. So
that's right. And there was a day that they were new also.
That's right. That's very true.
Okay. Brian says in this book, here's something else I underlined. This is one of the things that I like. You and I have talked a little bit about this before, but he says, if there's a key in practical shooting, it's just to become attuned to all your senses and know what's going on, as opposed to just focusing on one specific thing. What's your take on
that? Yeah, what that gets down to is you want to let your mind just be there to monitor the shooting. And that's what you're talking about, of being disattuned to your senses of what's happening. You don't want to put a thought into your mind of I'm looking for this, or I want to see this, or I'm anticipating this, or the last stage I did this, so therefore I'm going to look for that same sort of thing again, or whatever. You know, you just want your mind to be there to be monitoring the shooting and take care of the shooting for you, because it will. And whenever you start trying to override what your mind wants to do, it will negatively affect your shooting. And what I mean by that is you just won't be shooting to the highest level performance that you probably could shoot.
Well, and you know what's interesting is he also says here in one of his little footnotes, he says, always be on guard against trying.
Yeah.
Now this was profound. This kind of jumped off the page at me. Always be on guard against trying. And he goes on to explain, he says, when you sense that that's happening, just back off, watch, and see what happens. Now, what the heck does he mean by that?
Yeah, that's the whole entire thing, is trying means that you're actively engaging your mind into, well, I hate to say it, but trying to accomplish something or do something. I mean, you are engaging your mind to achieve some sort of outcome, or to be looking for something, or whatever the case may be. And again, when you do that, it means that basically your mind is not free to really just experience it and see what's going on and take control of the shooting for you, because that's when you're going to hit the highest level performance, is when you basically quit trying yeah, to make things happen, quit trying to take control of the shooting, and basically, you know, you have to just surrender that control. And it's difficult for a lot of people, because they want to take control of the situation and make it happen. It's part of the whole entire ego thing, where they want to be in control. And this whole entire idea of letting your mind really deal with the shooting and solve the problem for you is just something that a lot of people can't accept and are not willing to give up. So whenever you start trying to make something happen, that's the problem, is that you're basically just kind of deviating or directing your mind into a direction where it's not able to accomplish what it can accomplish for you.
Yeah. Well, and I'm going to say something here, because I want to tie this in a little bit to self-defense, to carrying, and hopefully, you know, if you have to use that gun in self-defense, like I always say, I hope I never find myself in that position. But if you do, let's liken this to that a little bit. I'm a firm believer you're going to revert to your level of competence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I like to talk about the experts and the people that really know what they're doing with a firearm. I know, Steve, maybe you don't like this terminology very much, but I do, because I was trained on it. I like to call the very best the unconscious competent. In other words, when I say unconscious competent, I don't mean that they're sleeping. I mean that they don't have to think about it. They don't have to try. They don't have to say, okay, now I do this, now I do this, now I do this. They just automatically know what to do because they've practiced it so much.
Yeah, what you call the unconscious competent, I call the subconscious competent, but it's really the same thing.
Yeah, same words. But you think, is that what Brian's talking about here?
Yeah, I think it is, because whenever when you're trying to do something, that takes time and thought process, where in a situation like a defensive situation like that, you're not going to have enough time to try to think yourself through the situation, especially right, in a high speed situation of a basically a fight or flight, do it right now or die, basically, is what it amounts to. I mean, you might have, if the situation goes along long enough, you might think about, you know, where you're at in terms of cover or where what your next move should be. But if you are literally thrown into a situation where you have to act and you have to act right now, thinking or trying to figure out what you're going to do is just time that you don't have.
Good point. Okay, Brian talks about winning in this chapter two.
Chapter also.
Another footnote. See, I love these little footnotes. I like it when an author writes books and they put these little notes over in the margins, because it basically, you know, they say in two sentences what it takes them to say on the whole page,
right.
You know. But I love it. He says, wanting to win is a contradiction. Now, here's the way I interpreted it. Tell me if I'm on or if I'm off. A lot of people show up and they want to win. And it's contradictory to what you should be doing. You just need to be there concentrating on the stimulus that's going around you and concentrate on the shooting. Do you agree?
That's true, because in reality, when it comes down to matches, winning is based on your performance of how well you shoot. Okay, mm-hmm. It's not based on your desire to win. When it gets down to it, it's how fast you shot and how many points you scored at the end of the match.
Right.
So, that's what wins matches, is how well you shoot, not wanting to win or having that, you know, I'm going to go out and win this match. That's not what's going to get the job done. What gets the job done is you shooting in a very efficient match without any penalties, without any wasted motion, without any wasted time, anything like that. The other problem is that putting this thought in your mind of wanting to win, again, and we've mentioned this before, is putting mm-hmm. thoughts in your mind and deviating or sending your mind off in a direction that's not going to help you at all in terms of what you need to do, which is shoot the match.
Yeah, and since you're talking about shooting the match, he says on page 124, he says, in a match, shoot at a pace that you could shoot successfully every time. See, I made a comment once on one of my podcasts. I said, slow down and win.
Right.
And somebody told me that. I forgot who it was, but he was a very, very good shooter. And I was just getting started, and he said, Bob, slow down. He says, if you slow down, you'll win. And I looked at him like he had to be absolutely crazy, you know, because everybody's trying to be speedy.
Right.
How can I slow down and win?
Right.
But I think what Brian's saying here is, in a match, shoot at a pace that you can do it successfully every time, because if you do that, if you slow yourself down, shoot at a successful pace for you, eventually the speed will come.
Right. If you look at who wins matches and how they win it based on consistency. They don't mm-hmm. win it based on they go out and they just annihilate everybody on one or two stages and then blow, you know, three or four. They may not win every stage, but they're up there, let's say, in the top five of every stage that they shoot. So they're right. shooting at a pace that's very repeatable and very consistent and not making mistakes. They're not basically trying to go to 110% and trying to come off with those one or two stage wins. That's not the way, you know, to win matches, and that's not the way to have a really good match. It's basically crash and burn, or you know, be a hero. It's the hero or zero effect. A lot of people recommend that if the place to push is in practice, and then when you go into a match, dial it down to about 90% of whatever your practice speed is, where you mm-hmm. can consistently shoot a comfortable pace. Because if you go out at practice and push hard, then when you go into a match and dial it down to 90%, it's going to feel like you're coasting. I mean, it's just going to feel like a walk in the park rather than yeah. you trying to be at your limit. And when you're at your limit and you cross it, that's when you have, you know, the crash and burn effect.
Boy, isn't that the truth? And there's so many people that just try to go way too fast. And, you know, I look at them and I go, you know, surely you don't practice that way. You know, I mean, and if you do, you should be better than you are at being fast.
Right, right. Yeah, it's hard to say whether they practice that way and they just haven't figured out. Well, you know what? It could be. It could be one or two things. Either they do practice that way and they haven't figured out how to turn it down, or mm-hmm. two, they don't practice at all.
Yeah, or they practice very, very slowly and they're trying to crank it up during a match.
Right, which is exactly the wrong approach to take. It's just right. 180 degrees of what you should be doing. You shouldn't be going slow in practice and then say, okay, in a match I'm going to turn it up to 11 and try to go really fast. I mean, it's the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Brian adds to that. He says, let the adrenaline of the match and your heightened sense of awareness enter your score. That's cool. What does that mean?
I think what he's, you know, that's a good question.
Well, I mean, let's think about it for a second. Let the adrenaline of the match and your heightened sense of awareness enter your. Here's my take. My take is he's trying to say just focus on being aware, just focus on know what's going on, the stimuli that's around you, and just let the rest of it take care of itself.
Yeah, the key phrase in that sentence is your heightened sense of awareness. Once I read that again, that's really what it's driving it. The adrenaline gets you basically pumped up, and getting you pumped up, I think, kind of to a certain degree excites everybody that they become very just kind of aware of everything that's happening around them. And when you're kind of like in an excited state like that, you're really, most people don't tunnel focus, but they really just become kind of like attuned to everything. And that's the heightened sense of awareness, I think, that he's talking about here. And the heightened sense of awareness, like we've been saying before, is that Brian is very big on this kind of like monitoring the shooting, being aware of everything that's happening while you're shooting, just kind of like seeing everything. And I think that's what he's kind of talking about is also letting your mind just basically be aware or experience the shooting part of it and take control of the situation. So through a heightened sense of awareness of what's going on, it really allows you to reach a peak level of performance.
Good. Thanks for adding that in there. Okay, the last topic I want to talk about, and this is not the last topic in Chapter 5. There's a lot more. But we'll have to save that for another day, excuse me, because I have some other things I want to talk to you about. But I want to talk about visualization. You know, Brian says that visualization works for him. And, you know, as it applies to shooting, visualization essentially is mental rehearsal. And I like that. It's mental rehearsal. Now, do you use any kind of visualization techniques before you go shoot?
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, tell us about it.
So typically on a stage like that, what you want to do is basically get yourself in kind of like a spot, secluded spot, where you're not being interrupted or disturbed by anybody else. And a lot of times I find it's easier to shut my eyes and do this just because you can kind of run, you know, the visualization better that way rather than actually seeing things. Because if you're seeing while you're visualizing, and I mean seeing through your eyes, then I think it's a distraction to your brain. So what I typically do is I'll shut my eyes and just picture myself shooting the stage. So I'll, you know, if there's targets to the left and targets to the right and a popper and blah, 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 that activates a swinger and something like that, I'll stand there and typically with my eyes shut and my hands out in front of me as if I was shooting. And I will just go through the whole entire process as if I was shooting the stage. Now, I've heard something mentioned before that your mind cannot distinguish between visualization and what it actually sees. And I think that's part of the key point here is that if you visualize something of rehearsing the stage, then your mind doesn't really know any different and it will basically go out there and execute what you just visualized. The second part of
good point. You better visualize it the correct way then.
Right. I mean, if you visualize it bad, you'll probably execute it bad. The other thing that Brian kind of points out is that he says he looks at visualization as if you were like looking at a map if you were going somewhere. So let's say you're driving, you know, to Dallas, okay, and you look at the map and you see the main road it goes to Dallas or whatever the case may be, and you're driving down the road, you know, basically that when you come up on a road and it has an arrow that says, you know, DFW or whatever the case may be, you know that's where you're going to turn because you looked at the map and you saw there was a road there. And now when you get to that spot in literally on your journey, you're expecting it and you see the arrow saying Dallas is this way and you know that's the direction to follow. Visualization is somewhat the same thing in that you will see a group of targets and you will execute them and then you can, you know, you'll see a wall or a barrier or a port or something that you shoot through. And it's kind of like visualization is kind of like looking at a map and that you, the journey is getting to the end of the stage and visualizing it is looking at the path of how to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of visualizing something. You know, I do that in a lot of different parts of my life. And, you know, I was really happy to read that here on page 125, because I think that's so important. You know, he calls it mental conditioning, and I couldn't agree more. And I think that it's just people have to be careful because, you know, you mentioned it just a minute ago. If you visualize it wrong, that's probably what your mind is going to default to, and that's what your mind's going to execute.
Right. And the other thing is, I think at times you can actually, he mentions it here, but you can actually over-visualize. If you keep doing something over and over and over and over in your visualization, at some point, I think you can almost, to a certain degree, kind of like become, I think, too obsessed with the visualization itself rather than what you're actually going to do. So I like to visualize something like maybe two or three times. But if you sit there and do it 10 times or whatever, I think, you
that's
know,
probably
it's
too much.
Like, it's kind of like the same thing as like if you ever think about, and you've had to deal with this before, of public speaking. You don't go out there and try to practice your speech 10 times. You might do it once and then basically just wing it once or twice and then wing it from there. Because you have it basically, it's like it's setting milestones or mile markers or whatever along the journey. It's the high points that you want to hit, but you're not working on every single small detail. And I think that's the problem when you over visualize something, is that you literally start getting down into the minutia of what you're trying to do rather than just letting your mind take control of the situation. So I think that's the thing with visualization, is that you want to kind of visualize it a couple times, hit the high points, the major points that you're going to see, a swinger, a group of targets, a port, or whatever. But and you don't want to get down to visualization of literally like seeing every single bullet hole that you're visualizing yourself firing into a target or anything like that.
A good point. Good point. I've caught myself trying to do that. So, all right. I think that as far as Chapter 5, we're going to have to actually do the rest of it some other time, because there's a whole bunch. It might even be another two or three more episodes.
Yeah, easily. There's a lot of stuff here.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff here. But I think for this show, this is a good stopping point. Now, let me shift gears a little bit, Steve.
Okay.
We talked about this a week and a half ago or so, but my recording software was all screwed up and it didn't come out right. So let's take 5 minutes or so. That's about it, 5 minutes, because I don't want to drag this on too long. But let's talk a little bit about rules, because a lot of the new shooters email me and they ask me, well, what about the rules? Am I going to have to pay attention to a bunch of rules? Am I going to have to, you know, am I going to get intimidated by a bunch of rules and things? And I always respond by saying, well, safety is the number one rule.
That's very true. I mean, safety is the main thing in all these games, and that's the highest level that we need to really, I mean, it's the number one rule of all this, it's being safe and following the safety rules that are laid out for us.
Absolutely. And for new shooters, that's all you got to worry about at first. But there are some distinctions between USPSA and IDPA, and I want you and I to point out some of those. And feel free to correct me if I get it wrong. But USPSA, one of the major differences is the way that USPSA allows you to perform a reload.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, in USPSA, you can basically reload whenever you want to, unless there's a stage description that says that you have to do something, you have to do something that's mandatory. Is that correct?
Right, that's true. And this, what you're describing there, is typically like a classifier, a course of fire, where it will say, you know, shoot T1, T2, T3 with two rounds per target, perform a mandatory reload, and re-engage T1, T2, and T3 with another two rounds per target. So they literally tell you they're, you know, when you have to reload or something of that nature. But other than those types of courses, you are basically, it's all freestyle. So you're free to solve the problem however you want to solve the problem, and you can reload whenever you want, and you can drop the mags on the ground if you wish.
Now, let's talk about that. You can drop the mags on the ground with ammo in them in USPSA. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And see, you can't do that in IDPA, and I think that's silly. I know there's some people that may argue with me. There's some tactical people that may, you know, really have issue with what I'm about to say. But, you know, these sports, I look at these sports basically sports for civilians to come and learn how to improve their gun handling skills. And I don't know that I necessarily agree with not dropping a mag with ammo on the ground, because the reasoning I always hear on that is, oh, well, you might need that ammo later.
Right.
Well, you know, look, if the fight has gotten to the point where you fired a bunch of rounds, you drop your mag, it's got two rounds left in it, you insert a fresh one, you keep on firing. If it's gotten that bad to where you have to go pick up your ammo that you dropped on the ground, I don't think you solved the problem well enough. That's, would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. The other thing to look at, and I understand, I mean, the first off, rules are rules, and every game has rules, and yeah. You know, I mean, if the rules were that you have to stand on your head and shoot targets, then that's what the rules are. It makes no sense, but it's a rule. You can come up with lots of rules in baseball or football probably too, which make no sense, but they are what they are.
Yeah.
But in terms of the magazine retaining ammo thing, I think the intent, like you said, was basically that you don't know where you're going or what's going to happen or when you get there, what you're going to need to do. So they want to hold on to as much ammo as you possibly can because you may find yourself in a situation where you need it. Now,
yeah.
IDPA kind of has this thing as part of its background of it broke away somewhat from USPSA to make things more practical or more of a realistic defensive scenario. So that's kind of like the courses that they set up are supposed to be simulations of real world examples, but that's kind of a farce in itself because, you know, real world, they don't follow any rules. So that kind of goes out the window. But, all right, let's continue with that anyway. So the question that you and I kind of brought up before about this is that, you know, depending on the capacity of the gun, statistics usually indicate that it's, what, 3 seconds, 3 yards, and 3 rounds fired, typically. Now, there are probably some variations of that, but probably for the most part, that probably holds pretty much true.
Yeah, for the majority. I mean, there's exceptions, but that's probably the majority.
Right. So even if, let's say, you're shooting a 1911, you've got 9 in the gun, 8 in the mag, 1 in the tube, plus another 8. You know, so you've got, if you're looking at the 3-3-3 rule there, you've got 3 gunfights worth of ammo in the gun right now, and almost another 3 more gunfights ready to go in your magazine. So you kind of start questioning, you know, this thing about saving ammo. I mean, what are you saving ammo for, and how many people are you actually trying to fend off? And again, you know, maybe you're attacked by 20 different people, but I don't know. I mean, I really kind of question the again, real world use of this or how it would be applied. And I think it would be interesting. And if any of your listeners have any, and, you know, don't give your name or whatever, but any realistic world experience with this who have been, I would probably either say who have been involved in a gunfight or an altercation, where you were presented with, you know, a couple individuals, or even it opened it up to maybe somebody who was involved in a situation in military where you are facing a lot of individuals and they were using, let's say, the Beretta M9 or whatever, because I want to eliminate the, you know, I've got 30 rounds in my magazine type deal with an AR or with the M16 or M4. But whether they ever had, were ever in a situation where they actually had to retain ammo and then go back to that magazine that they retained and, you know, and continue using it. Because my guess is you're not going to find anybody.
No, that's a good point. And, you know, a listener emailed this to me. He emailed this about a week or two ago, and I can't find the email right now on my computer. But it was something to the effect of, hey, Bob, could you interview somebody on your show that's actually been in a gunfight and have to do some of these things, like go retrieve a magazine or perform a tactical reload or a reload with retention? And I would love to get somebody on that either could explain why you should or why you shouldn't, that's been in an actual fight. You know,
right,
I mean,
right.
There's some people don't want to talk about it, and I understand that.
Yeah, I very well would understand that if they don't want to relive it again. Yeah.
Yeah, but okay, so that's one thing. That's one thing that would be really cool to hear from somebody. And that's a rule that I think is kind of silly. The other silly rule, before we wrap this up, is particularly to IDPA. You know, IDPA says things like, and the reason I'm going to ask this question is because of Billy's email earlier, Billy from Dallas. Mm-hmm. He wants to know about gear. IDPA says stuff like, okay, if you're going to shoot in stock service pistol and you buy a Glock, you can't take that Glock and you can't put, like, for example, a steel guide rod in it because it didn't come out of the box that way with a steel guide rod. But yet if you're shooting a Smith & Wesson M&P, which does have a steel guide rod out of the box, that's okay. And so, you know, I mean, there's some people like me. I like to use a steel guide rod because they're non-captured, and I can change out the springs easily. And you know, it's easier when I'm trying to switch springs. It's a little bit harder with a captured spring.
That's true. But I think the thing here is that the intent of SSP or stock service pistol is exactly that, stock service pistol. Mm-hmm. And the idea is they don't want to create an environment where people either feel compelled that they need to start basically screwing around with their equipment to try to make it more competitive,
right.
or just like, you know, getting into an equipment race where people can start messing around with their equipment and trying and literally pushing it beyond the stock level. And I guess that's where the enhanced service pistol division comes into play, where you can start playing around with that stuff and do that. So I think that's really the basis there, is that it's supposed to be stock. There are some things that they'll allow you to do, typically sights and stuff like that. But generally speaking, they want to keep the gun as stock as possible, so that I think newer shooters either coming into this don't feel that they need to go out and buy that steel guide rod or whatever to be competitive and keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. Now, in reality, a steel guide rod is not going to make your gun shoot any faster than a plastic guide rod.
That's right.
It might add a little bit of weight to the front end of the gun versus plastic, which will assist in recoil. You know, the next level beyond that is, well, not only going to replace my steel, or I'm sorry, not only going to replace my plastic guide rod, I'm going to replace it with a tungsten guide rod, which is going to add ounces to the gun, and that will tame recoil.
So I think that's
where it goes, is that it's saying, you know, it's supposed to be stock, and we don't want to open the door up to entertain any of these gamey things or people who are trying to push that edge or whatever. Now, okay, yeah, so the M&P comes with a steel guide rod, but I bet there's probably the same restriction in there. You can't change it to anything other than the steel guide rod. So you couldn't put in a plastic guide rod if you wanted to.
You couldn't put in a plastic one in there.
Right. And people would say, well, you know, why would you want to do that? I don't know. I mean, you know, but it is what it is. And it's basically that it's stock steel guide rod, and you can't change it for the same reason that you can't change a stock plastic guide rod. It's what comes with a gun. I guess if you want to go change your springs with a Glock, you've got to, if you really want to do it, take out the retaining pin at the end of the guide rod, which can be done, and change the spring and put it back in. But then, from what I understand, that you can only do that a couple times before the thing just won't hold anymore. So I've never done it.
Yeah.
I've never messed with my springs in my Glock 19. Never felt the need to.
Well, me, you know, and I did. I was one of those guys. I was Mr. Modification for a long time. I had to do everything under the sun that I could absolutely get away with in that division to make myself more competitive.
But and see, there you are. You just pointed out the exact point, is that you, it didn't, it probably didn't do anything for you, but you get caught up in this mindset. I need to do this. I need to change this. I need to be competitive with everybody else. And they think, you know, it's the thing, it's all about the equipment, not about the shooter. There's nothing I can possibly do to improve my shooting, so therefore I have to go and improve my gun, when in reality it's the exact opposite. There's probably nothing you can do to improve your gun to make you a better shooter.
And, you know, let me give a testimonial on that. You know, when I was messing around with my guns and I was trying to modify them, you know, 14 different ways to make me a better shooter, one day, this is when I was still living up in Oklahoma City, and I was shooting USPSA, and we were shooting at some steel.
Mm-hmm.
And when the match was over, somebody invited me to just hang around for a while and do some more steel shooting. So I said, okay. So I'm out there with, I think it was a Glock, I think it was my Glock 34 at that. Yeah, it was. It was the 34 that I had all, you know, tricked out as much as I could trick it out and stay within SSP.
Right.
Another guy shows up with a little XD9 subcompact. And he's the guy that invited me to shoot steel. So he kicked my butt with that XD9 subcompact, completely stock, just as it came out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
I'm there with my long slide, modified, tricked out, you know, everything I can do to an SSP gun and keep it legal, and he's blowing me away.
Right.
That's what dawned, made me think, you know what, just like you said, it's not the modifications that's going to make me a better shooter.
And then you're supposed to add the footnote, and then later on I found out his name was Rob Latham.
Yeah, and later on when I asked him his name.
Yeah, his name is Rob. Rob, really? Where do you
come from? Yeah, so I said, hey, can I have your autograph?
Yeah. No, and that's just it, is that it's, I mean, yes, there are certain things you can do to the, I mean, I will admit, there are certain things you can do to a gun to make it easier to shoot, but generally speaking, you're not going to get to that point to be able to benefit from that until you really learn how to shoot,
exactly.
And that's just it. I mean, we see a lot of newer shooters, I can take seconds off their time by just looking at their fundamentals of what they do and how they attack a stage and stuff like that. And it has, I mean, I could take seconds off a person's time and nothing having to do with the shooting part of it, but just basically how they approach a stage. I mean, there's a lot of time to be gained there. So, and then the shooting is the next level of how to improve the shooting technique. So, after you get through learning how to shoot stages and how to have proper fundamentals, and then you get down into actually shooting, you know, the next level is the little things you can do to your gun to make it easier to shoot. And that's really about the last thing that you should be working on. But unfortunately, it's the first thing that people want to mess with.
Yeah, and that was me. It was the first thing I wanted to mess with.
Yeah.
And so I did. I messed with it. And, you know, thank God I didn't screw up my guns. But I did not become a better shooter by screwing around with my firearm and making all kinds of modifications. I became better just by getting out there and practicing and doing it.
And that's the other thing that you see, is that people start messing with their guns so much that they start wondering why all of a sudden they're not very reliable, or they start having feed failures, or why the trigger doesn't work, or, I mean, whatever, and, you know.
Yeah, and you know, in closing, I want to say this. You know, 1911s unfairly get a bad rap in the competition world. They get a bad rap about being unreliable. And 95 times out of 100, if there's a 1911 out there that's choking and malfunctioning during a match, it's because its owner probably did something to modify it and probably screwed something up.
Probably so.
You know, or its owner is reloading ammo and he's not reloading it correctly, and he's not following the proper, reloading procedures, and it that's causing the gun to malfunction.
Yeah, along those same lines, we got a viewer email to Power Factor, and the guy was asking about my STI, and he said, you know, I've heard that, they're great guns, but they take a lot of money to get them to be reliable. And I have had exactly the opposite. I have not had any problem with that gun whatsoever. Now it could be because of the fact that I bought it from Dawson Precision, and they claim that they go through all the guns and make sure that they, you know, basically give them a once over before they send them out the door. It could be that, you know, I talked to some of my friends who were actually already shooting limited and said, how long do you load your ammo and what do I need to do? But basically, long story short, it's run perfect. And I think that's part of it, is that people get into this kind of mindset that a certain gun isn't reliable or takes a lot of effort to make it go. And sometimes 1911s get that. But I think you're right. I think more often than not, people screw them up by trying to mess with them and improve them rather than just, you know, to a certain degree, leaving them alone. And there are certain modifications that you can do to improve accuracy and things like that. But sometimes people go about it the wrong way of trying to, like, you know, pinch the slide to rail fit of the gun, thinking that's going to improve accuracy. And yes, it does, but it also... it does improve accuracy, but the benefit is not as high as what you would think it would be. But that's the first thing they go after, and unfortunately, they decrease the reliability of it in the process of doing that.
Yeah, but there's some gunsmiths making some money off of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
unless the owners are doing the modifications themselves, which sometimes that's even more dangerous unless you really know what you're doing.
Yeah, that's in terms of gunsmithing, you really need to find a gunsmith who is good and has a proven track record, and talk to people who have used that gunsmith to build them guns or have work done on them, and make sure that they're happy with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay. This is a good stopping point. Thanks, Steve. And thanks for coming on and sharing this good information. Any final thoughts for people listening?
The one thing is, you have the tools, you have the equipment, get out there and get involved in the sport, and don't, you know, say, well, I don't have the right stuff, or I'll do it next year, or whatever the case may be. Get out there and get involved right now. You'll thank me later, let's put it that way.
Exactly.
Because it is a lot of fun, and it really does improve your gun handling skills. It improves your shooting skills. It allows you to do things that you can't normally do on a square range or even dream about doing on a square range, and it's just a kick.
Yeah, it is. It really is, and thanks for saying that. Okay, well, it's late at night, and I have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to catch a flight.
Oh, boy.
Out of town tomorrow. So this was fantastic. One more time, give out your website and the link to your show.
Okay, yeah. The website is powerfactorshow.com. Email is powerfactorshow@gmail.com, and we're on iTunes. And we're also on Zune, so you can go search for it there and download it. There's a video feed and an audio feed.
Great. Steve Zofi, Masterclass USPSA shooter, everybody. Thanks for joining me, and safe shooting, okay?
Thanks, Bob, and have a safe flight tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Take care.
All right, you too. Bye.
Bye.